Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00074. Recorded on March 14, 2024. Production location, Post-Harlan, Texas. Bones of Contention, Part 2. Bones of Contention, Part 2. Chapter 74.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88. This monologue is continued from the previous episode, Chapter 00073, Bones of Contention, Part 1.
So how about more counter pop culture or pop counter culture bones, right? Music reference bones. Radiohead, right? English band. English band. From the 90s on, who I was very admittedly a big, big fan of, not at this point in time. This song I'm getting into here is called Bones, go figure, right? Bones, it's on their second LP, right? So it's early on in their history, and on that album, their LP, like I said, their second LP called The Bends, right? The Bends, like as a diver going down. Very peculiar album cover on there. Reminds me of somebody who I used to preach the gospel with, right? Like street preaching and everything. Dude on it looks just like him. It's very weird. But anyway, yeah, from the Bends LP, their second release, right? Radiohead, which I'm not sure when it was dated. Probably around the same time as Alice in Chains' Dirt and Tom Waits' Bone Machine, at the early 90s, maybe mid-90s, OK Computer, I think, the third LP, was 95 or 96, so it had to be like 92, 93, 94, somewhere in there, right? Anyway, it was their second album, and at this point in time in their history, on their first album called Pablo Honey, right, they had their anthemic song, right, which, of course, the band, especially the singer Tom York, and I've spoken about him kind of at length in a very, very early ancient episode. Tom York never really cared for the song. He thought it was just kind of a throwaway. It was not very deep and meaningful. It was not inspired particularly by any book that he had read, which so much of his inspiration had come from, right? And that's why some of his lyrics, outside of the fact that he's a Brit and he uses British words sometimes, but his influence can be vague unless you know the story behind the lyrics, right? He would read a book and he would be inspired by the book, and there's a story in the book, and if you don't know that, you don't get it, you know? You're not with it, and you're not hip. It's all that same kind of bullshit, right? But anyway, The Bends, right, was their second album, and on that album they had a song called The Bones. And I gotta tell you, I bring up all this kind of history of, because I was not a Radiohead fan until like 2003, 2004, when I was hanging around with a bunch of clean and sober recovering people who were like 10 to 15 years younger than me, right? It just happened this way. All these younger people, like college age people, when I was in my mid-30s, were hanging out in my apartment, even like while I was at work and everything like that. They were kind of flopping. Some of them had jobs, some of them didn't have jobs. It's a whole story, right? It's a whole story. This is kind of like a 6 to 8 month period of my life back then. And these people, right? These people very much like Radiohead. And that's where I started to hear Radiohead that I hadn't heard before. All I knew was this one song that Tom York so hated, but made him so famous and made him so rich. Creep, right? It's literally a Generation X grunge era anthem that stands the test of time to this day. And that was the only song I knew. That was the one that got radio play. Nothing seemed to get radio play off of this album in particular. There was a couple of songs of note on it through time, but the band really picked up and became who they are with the following release. And now in this album, you had songs that kind of harken back to the first albums and songs that were starting to look forward to the third album and their destiny as a group, you know, as they finally congealed, their cohesiveness, it all came together and they became really at the core what they were. But here, this was like a bridging moment, the bends, right? As far as I'm concerned, anyway. So some of the songs harken back, some of the songs were looking forward. This song, Bones by Radiohead, was kind of harkening back. It really had a feel from something from Pablo Honey, the first album. And as a result of that, that was kind of like a flyover song to me. Every time I listened to the LP in total, The Bends, this was like one of the songs that was just a flyover between, songs that I actually liked and cared to hear. But I flew over it enough times that I'm very familiar with the song, right? And I never really gave it all the consideration in the world, thematically, lyrically, until now. Now I look at the lyrics, they're very simple lyrics, and it seems, you know, there's the typical Radiohead vagary to it. Who wrote the lyrics must have had something very particular on his mind, and it's really hard to form a very complete analysis based on the lyrics and even based on the expression and the melody. You know, it's just where bones come into the play is a matter of that a person needs to feel it, quote unquote, it, whatever it is, in their bones. It's like you have to feel it in your bones. You have to. It's like the singer is appealing to somebody else that they've got to feel it in their bones. What it is what is vague, right? But there is a reference in the song which gets interesting to me, and it gets my mind going off on a tangent that I am, at this time, very much willing to go down momentarily, right? He mentions specifically about psychotropic medications, Prozac for one, right? And then painkillers for another. Prozac, of course, is something that is prescribed here in the 21st century to people suffering with depression and then probably some other problems as well. But it's typically known as an antidepressant. It actually came into notoriety late 80s, early 90s, right? And it's been kind of like a staple of that psychiatric culture on both sides of the desk, right? Ever since, right? So the mention of these songs, now one of them being a psychiatric medication, the other one being a painkiller, they both have the commonality of psychotropic. Now let me define psychotropic for you, just so you know out there in the year 2224, right? Psychotropic, having an altering effect on perception, emotion, or behavior, used especially of a drug, right? So when you're talking about psychotropic drugs or psychotropic medication, you're talking about something that will have some kind of effect on you. It may affect your perception. It may affect your emotion. It may affect your behavior. And of course, the three are not mutually exclusive. In fact, they often, all three of them are incorporated into the effects that drugs have on people, right? But basically, a psychotropic drug is one that alters you mentally some way, right? And that is the avenue that I wish to pursue at this moment in time. Again, I don't know what the hell the band was writing about specifically because of the vagary of their lyrics. And these lyrics are really very thin anyway. There's really no clue to anything in what they're talking about. You just need to feel it in your bones, and then there's this problem with these psychotropic drugs. And all I can really make of it is that if you're taking these drugs, you cannot feel it in your bones, right? There's a perception issue going on here, which I probably have spoken to at some length, time and time again, as a recovering addict and alcoholic, right? Who has definitely gone through times of very skewed perception. The part that I want to point out, though, and it's something that these lyrics are kind of like standing at the threshold of, but just cannot break through, because why? These are not people of faith when you're talking about Radiohead, right? They're not people of faith. They may be Buddhists, they may be atheists, some kind of humanists, but they are sure enough not Christian, and absolutely definitely not Orthodox Christian, right? But it seems like they've got something very important in their grasp in these lyrics, right? You've got to feel it, right? I said quote unquote it. We don't know what the it is. It's not defined. And I think that's the important part. That's what's really missing here. What the it actually is, in my opinion, not that they understand it as they wrote it. It seems like they understand that they don't understand what it is because they didn't ever say what it is, right? I'm telling you what it is. It is God with a capital G. Some may say the Holy Spirit. Well, that is also God with a capital G, right? You've got to feel it in your bones. Now, you've heard me speak, if you listen to me at any length at all, about this kind of this conscious contact that I have with God directly, right? Where there's like an unspoken language that I know. Right? And you could say, it's something that I feel in my bones. But if I was on psychotropic medication, if I was on psychotropic drugs of any kind, right? Anything that alters my mind, my perception, my behavior, all this stuff that these drugs do, I would not have this connection with God. It gets blocked. I've made reference to Led Zeppelin lyrics on these lines before, from the song on Led Zeppelin 2, Living, Loving, Made. When your conscience hits you, knock it back with pills. That is exactly what I'm talking about right here. You have no ear to hear, no inner ear to hear, to perceive your conscience when you're whacked out on drugs. And you don't have to be whacked out on drugs. You simply have to be on them to the point where your perception or your behavior or your emotions are skewed by them. Now you are living in a non-reality or an alternate reality, you might say, and you are disconnected from anything that, well, some very important things that are actual in life, like the presence of God in your living being. We can intentionally intentionally kick God out of our lives anytime he knocks on the door. When we are into, quote-unquote, misbehaving, right? When we're into, quote-unquote, sin, when we're into indulgences of things that are wicked and not good. We don't want to hear about God. We don't want to hear about Jesus Christ. We don't want to hear about the Holy Spirit. We don't want to hear about conscience. We don't want to have to second guess the decision we made to go destroy ourselves and others in pursuit of our euphoric sense of contentedness, right? Wow, that was a lot to say right there. Sometimes I give myself credit. Sometimes I give myself my coffee the credit. Today it's a little dab of chock full of nuts. That's got the wiring all in order for a change. Good for you. Good for me. You see what I'm saying, though? You see what I'm saying? This is what I'm able to glean out of those lyrics. I make, obviously, mountains out of molehills when I get to thinking about these things. But it's something. It's there. And now when I hear this song again, it's going to reflect on this with me. But again, to me, in my mind, for how many zillions of times I've thought this through, not this song particularly, but the concept I just described to you about blocking God out by the use of drugs, right? It's almost sophomoric to me. It's almost like, you're a kid, you understand this, right? It's almost something you wouldn't write a song about, except for if it gets very personal. If you know somebody who's in this situation, you know somebody, cares somebody who has to take medication or feels they have to take medication or has been convinced that they have to take medication, that could and likely would potentially get in the way of a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Now you've got a very sad story. This could be the most grievous, soft rain of sad, sorrowful blues that a person could put into a song. Because now what you have here is grief of the dead, but the dead yet live. Because we're grieving the walking dead. We're grieving people that are separated from God in order to feel that they can get along. And they're not getting along. They're getting condemned. It's heavy. It's heavy to think. And my thoughts are way heavier than that song or its music, its melody, anything really is. And maybe I'm taking it a little bit too far. Let's move along. But, thank you for allowing me to ruminate on some of this stuff, right? Yeah, to have a wall between yourself and God. Look, if you don't believe in God or you don't want to believe in God, that's one thing. But to, decapitate yourself from the possibility of realizing that at some point in your life, wow. You really just condemned yourself. And that's a sad, sad thing. In fact, on a daily basis, an almost daily basis, as I say, I'm not perfect, right? I pray. I actually have a list of people who I know are some kind of mentally ill, personally, that are likely, if not definitely, on some kind of medication like this. And my prayers, amongst other very important things, include this idea of somehow getting through them or to them to get away from the medication and lean on Christ to resolve what these problems are, because God is the healer. God is the provider. He's all these things. We have so many examples in the Gospels of the power of Christ to heal all kinds of ailments. And I've given you my personal testimony of certain things that have been wrong with me. And hey, don't forget the part where I had psychological issues. I'm not going to call them psychiatric because that medication then didn't do shit for me, right? I had psychological issues that needed to be resolved. And the resolution came when I came to faith. And then I started putting some of the lesser habits of my existence off the pasture, right? Putting some of that shit behind me. When I got free and clear of living wrongly, and at the same time being given over to Christ, all of a sudden there were no more psychological issues. There was no more depression. And long before I got even to that point, I was able to put the drugs and alcohol behind me with just a scant idea of some distant higher power out there that I had to journey to discover. And it took me 19 years of that. But just the knowledge and the general belief that it was some kind of quote-unquote God with a capital G that was responsible for getting me clean and sober and holding me this way in spite of myself, even psychological issues, even quote-unquote mental illness, was able to be overcome without the use of the psychiatric / psychotropic medications anymore. You see that? You see that? It's an important thing to me. So let's move on. Another important thing to me is Holy Scripture, right? The Bible. How the hell can I talk about bones and not come to Ezekiel 37, where it talks about the Valley of Dry Bones, right? Valley of Dry Bones. This I do not want to ruminate on for very long, right? This is something I just want to speak to right quick, because this becomes a whole nother conversation, right? A whole nother conversation. There is certainly a quote-unquote bone of contention where this scripture is concerned. And I'll talk about a bone of contention later on, because I'm living in one now, right? With my job. But let me just put that off a moment here. The Valley of Dry Bones is a vision that Ezekiel is presented with that ultimately ends up representing the resurrected condition, a resurrection of Israel. I'll just quote unquote Israel, right? Israel. Now, when I say Israel, 99% of the people are going to think Israel, that country that is currently performing some kind of genocide against these Palestinian people, right? That's what's happening in the news, and it has been happening in the news for a few months now, right? Kind of a big deal, right? Kind of a big deal what's going on over there. It's not as big a deal as they're making it, but any kind of genocide attempt is, in the grand scheme of things, is just a horrific thing. And I don't have really a dog in that race. I see it basically as Jews and Muslims, that they're both antichrist, and it's not my concern. But what I do know is Palestinians are actually made up of more than just Muslim. There's a significant Christian community in and amongst them. So I am going to always lean towards that side and look at them as innocent in this situation. And I care about my Christian brethren. And I don't know whether they're Orthodox, whether they're Protestant, whether they're Roman. They're Christian, and they're Christian in a very hard place to be Christian. That's what I care about, right? I care about them people first and foremost. And then the whole Israel thing, right? As I said, 99% of the people will automatically, their mind will go to Israel when I say the word Israel. They'll think about that geopolitical entity that imposed upon the rest of the world state, created by the Rothschilds family in conjunction with their British cohorts back in the early 1900s, right? A movement that actually started in the 1800s. You heard me rail about all this kind of stuff, right? Zionism creates that state. Well, this is not what I'm talking about, but here's where the bone of contention is. Most people see Israel and think that right there, right? That this vision of Ezekiel's about the Valley of Dry Bones, right? Now, what you got in this vision is these dry bones, God commanding Ezekiel to tell these bones like to come to life, and they start just reassembling themselves, right? Sinew by sinew, and all these connective tissue and all this stuff coming together, right? Now the bones become skeletons, and then Ezekiel's commanded to like tell the winds to breathe life into them, and the winds come and they all become alive, all these skeletons, and they turn into flesh and like they're living people, resurrected once again. And it's made plain that this is a vision that is revealing a resurrection of quote-unquote Israel. Now, the problem is, you know, Ezekiel is one of the prophets that have so much of their prophecy pointed to the Babylonian captivity, right? The 70 years in captivity that the Israelites, right? The southern kingdom of Judah, right, J-U-D-A-H, would go through. And then, while captive in Babylon, the Persian Empire would overcome the Babylonians, right, who had sacked Jerusalem and created this captivity situation 70 years earlier, right? Persians come in and allow these Judahites, right, to go back to Jerusalem, rebuild the city, rebuild the temple, and only a comparatively small trace handful took up that opportunity, because in the 70 years, a couple generations had gone by, and guess what? These Jews set up businesses. They became merchants. They were doing very well in Babylon. They decided they was just going to stay, right? But for the handful that went back, they started to build back that nation. And that is the resurrected condition that goes with the vision of Ezekiel. You can stretch it out further to the coming of Christ and the resurrection that comes with the resurrection of Christ, and then Israel becoming the eternal nation that is now. Not that 1948 piece of shit out in the desert out there, right? That is not Israel. Israel, for them, is a co-opted name, all right? Israel is the kingdom of Christ on this world. And it always was the kingdom of Christ on the world, even before there was any Israel, even before Jacob's name was changed to Israel. Israel always existed as the kingdom of Christians in this world. Again, heavy stuff, more than you're ready to swallow now. I know. But eventually, maybe, right? Eventually. Baby steps. You'll get it. So yeah, the Valley of the Dry Bones. So you see what the contention is. What exactly does Israel mean? And that is a great question that I would encourage all of you all to ask yourselves routinely and come up with some actual answers to it. You'd be surprised at some of the shit that you dig up when you ask that question. Go to the internet, find out what exactly is Israel. All kinds of perspectives on it. Ultimately, it comes down to what the Bible tells you that it is. And what the Bible tells you that it is what I just told you that it is. I promise. I absolutely promise that to be so. Now, moving way over into a completely different direction, because we're going to go back now into pop counterculture or counterculture pop, right? I still haven't decided how I want to do that. Counterculture pop probably sounds about right, right? And this goes back earlier than the early 90s. All these references so far seems to be like early 90s. This goes back to like 1980, right? 1980. And I remember this. I remember when this happened. There was suddenly, in my perception, from my perspective, there was suddenly this band called AC/DC, right? They were from Australia. They are from Australia. They still go today. They've had some key components die off on the way, but and actually, this is where the story begins. The album was called Back in Black. And right off the top, I mean, as far as I was concerned, it was the first AC/DC album there ever was, because I never heard of them before. Nobody ever talked about them. I was in the seventh grade, right? So I went a little while before I discovered that they had all these other albums. They had a whole catalog, like, through most of the 70s. What had happened was they had a singer, right? A singer who died, right? Because it happens, I mentioned that before. Singers die. This guy wasn't a heroin addict or anything like that. He was kind of a drunkard, and he died of some kind of misadventure. I think a car wreck or something like that, but I don't really know for sure. Don't hold me to that. His name was Bon Scott, right? And really, AC/DC kind of plays out like this. There's two songs you need to hear by them, and you've heard them all, right? One of them is Highway to Hell, which is a Bon Scott song. And the other one is You Shook Me All Night Long, which is a song without Bon Scott, right? The new singer comes along after Bon Scott dies. You have those two songs at your disposal, and you really have heard all there is to hear about AC/DC, because every single song is of Bon Scott's is just like that, and every single song without Bon Scott is just like that. That's all the two you need. You don't need two albums. You don't need 20 years of songs. You need two songs by them, right? And that's the beef that I have, right? Speaking of beef, the beef that I have with AC/DC is that every song is the same. It's the same construction of the lyrics change, and that's about it. But when Back in Black came out, it was very popular. To my ears, to my young ears, it was like, holy shit, you know? And it was really cool. Everybody loved it. And, you know, that happened to be the pinnacle of their creativity and of their success, that album right there. They made many more albums after that, but that was it. That Back in Black was a thing. And what I think a lot of people don't realize, see, I'm not a humongous fan of AC/DC because of that. It just, you heard it, you heard this much, you heard it all, right? Back in Black was the album. Back in Black was also a song on the album. And the concept of Back in Black is that here's this band returning, but they're dressed in black. They're mourning the death of their friend and their bandmate, Bon Scott. Right? So they're coming back with mourning, creating this record. This is how AC/DC, these guys from Australia, mourn the loss of their friend, right? That's what was going on. That's what Back in Black means. It's a mourning thing of the death of Bon Scott. I bet you there's a lot of AC/DC fans devoted, wearing the t-shirt 8 days a week, that have no idea that that's what that means. I promise. But that's what that's all about. I didn't read that anywhere. You just put two and two together, right? If you know any of the history of the band and the time sequence, the chronology of things, that's exactly what that's about. And what a great way to do the seemingly impossible. I mentioned this earlier, right? How do you have the lead singer of a band die, replace the lead singer, and carry on, right? Now, you can do it. Many bands carry on, but they're never going to be what they were. Because the lead singer so frequently is the entire persona of the band, right? Now, you're going to have some exceptions. I think of Van Halen. Van Halen's a good one, right? I brought that up recently. You had David Lee Roth, and then he got kicked out. Right? He got kicked out. But while David Lee Roth was in the band, and really, he was the face of the band, and he was the personality of the band, you still had Eddie Van Halen, who was the guitar virtuoso, who changed the way guitar was played, right? You really had two kind of things going on there. And it was a matter of which was the more powerful visual representation of what Van Halen was. It turns out David Lee Roth was that, believe it or not, right? I'm not a big fan, don't get me wrong. In the day, when I was drinking, I loved Van Halen. Early Van Halen, David Lee Roth Van Halen. When he was kicked out, he got replaced by Sammy Hagar, who's a talented person. But it was never the same. Not one song that they ever did without David Lee Roth compared to anything that they did with him. A couple things fit into that outcome, really. The band aging, the success and fame of the band, and then obviously a different bandmate who's contributing to both the music and lyrical content and also the stage performance. It just would never be the same again. And that's how it would go for just about any band that lost their lead singer. There's very few exceptions. AC/DC is one of those exceptions. They were able to leave Bon Scott behind and carry on. In fact, their first step out the gate in an attempt to carry on was the greatest effort they ever had. So what you know about AC/DC is Bon Scott really wasn't the band. The band actually was the guitar player, the lead guitar player, Angus Young, right? Because Angus Young, it was all built around him, and that's why all the songs were the same. He played what he played, and everything fit to what he did, and you could just throw in any other musician around it, and it probably would have worked out, right? A rare case. Now, I say all this shit about AC/DC and throw in Van Halen and all this other stuff, right? Just to get to the part about the bone. On that Back in Black LP, there's a song called Giving the Dog a Bone, right? It's spelled G-I-V-E-N, spelled incorrectly. I don't know who's responsible for that. I don't know if that's intentional. I don't know if that was an oversight. That's the way it's spelled. The song is without remorse, in your face, and that's kind of tongue-in-cheek, which is... it's a blowjob song. So that makes it actual, true, to the definition, rock and roll. It's Australian rock and roll. It's raunchy rock and roll. It belongs in the strip club. That's what it's for. But the entire song is about oral sex. Straight up, no doubt. Always was, always will be. That's what the song is about. I never, ever in my life thought to write lyrics about a blowjob. But AC did it for us, and we don't need any more of that now. But giving the dog a bone, right? So there's another bone for you. Don't get between a dog and his bone, right? Giving the dog a bone. Don't get between a dog and his bone, right? The dog wants the bone. If he's going to eat the bone, he's going to eat you on the way to the bone if you get in the way. And that's an idiom, right? And speaking of dogs eating bones, I have this recollection going back to those same days, you know, junior high. I had a buddy of mine, one of my friends who died of that COVID shit, right? He was literally up in New York City when it happened, which in the United States was like ground zero for COVID deaths. They wanted people to die up there. It was good for the numbers, right? But this guy got caught up in it, and I don't know exactly how it all played out, but he was a junior high school friend of mine, and I kind of disconnected from him in high school. I had a conversation with him before he died, and he said we smoked a few bones together, speaking of bones, somewhere in high school, right? I had gone completely wayward from most of my junior high friends. I switched crowds dramatically while I was on drugs. But most of the people that I went to school with eventually would, you know, quote unquote, experiment with drugs. So maybe senior year in high school, I would start to see a lot of people at parties that really weren't part of the whole quote unquote burnout society that we had going on. Our own counterculture, our own subculture that I've spoken at length about in prior episodes. But this guy in junior high, he gave me just, I don't know, it's like at the end of the school year or something, he was cleaning out his desk. He had this statue of a gargoyle, right? Like from Paris or something, right? It's this upright thing. It's vertical, and it's like half of this gargoyle creature, and he's holding a bone also vertically, and he's like gnawing on the end of the bone, right? You may have seen this somewhere. It's kind of the one common rendition of these gargoyles that are all over like Gothic buildings and shit back in Europe. So he had this little gargoyle statue, and he gave it to me, and I was like, all right, I took it, you know, and I kept it in my room. It was like on my shelf with the books and everything and records and whatever. And I also remember like the following year, I brought it in. I had an art class, and we were doing like sculpture stuff. So I brought that in, and I made like, I don't know, 5 or 6 replicas of this thing. There was like gargoyles all over our school, right? I just kept making these, and it was just like a silly phase I went through. But this thing was like chewing on a bone. And I look, now, when I say this gargoyle, I look at it, it looks like my dog Henry, right? in my memory, right? I see Henry the pit bull, and when I look at him, I'm reminded of this gargoyle chewing on a bone. There's a very similar look to him. So this gargoyle actually looked like a dog, a particular kind of dog, right? And you know, not with the pointy ears type, like a German Shepherd, for example. And yeah, I just see that all the time. So they think of this AC/DC song, Giving the Dog a Bone, knowing exactly what it's about, right? But just taking it literal at face value, giving a bone to a dog. Now I see Henry chewing on a bone, like the Texas T-bone that I would bring him from Texas Roadhouse, right? That I was talking about earlier. And then when I see Henry chewing on the bone, I see this gargoyle in my memory, right? Ain't that crazy? Right? Ain't that crazy? Now, not only does Henry the pit bull look like this gargoyle statue that I used to have when I was a kid, right? Not only does he remind me of that, I actually call Henry the gargoyle, our neighborhood gargoyle, because all day long he sits in the front window and just watches everything that happens in the neighborhood. Now, it used to be we had a sectional couch that bent around and went in front of that window, and he would climb on top of the couch. And I mean on top. He would go like up to the headrest area, and he would like dangle over it, right? So he was like looking down on the neighborhood from his perch, like a gargoyle, right? Now we've got, we got rid of that couch. Now we got just one straight couch on another wall, and he's got a very special bed that I bought for him. $100 for this thing, right? Big old thing. People can sleep on it, you know? But it's very low to the ground. And I'm anticipating the coming months, possibly the coming years, when he's just not capable of climbing up on a couch anymore. Every single dog that we've had put to sleep went through that when they got into old age, right? They couldn't get up on a couch anymore. So I'm trying to get ahead of it. So he lays on the ground, basically, a very low bed, and he looks over the neighborhood like a gargoyle. So, moving on from the gargoyle thing. A bone idiom. I-D-I-O-M. Idiom, right? A bone idiom. And here it is, one of them. There's many. I'll just throw a couple out at you before we part ways. Working your fingers to the bone, right? Working your fingers to the bone. And what that is a reference to is putting in very hard work for a very long time to the point where you're actually doing yourself some harm, right? Now, in the idiom, it's a physical representation. It's actually like you work your hands. You're doing the work with your hands so hard for so long that you've actually lost your layers of skin and muscle, and now you're right down to the bone. Like, there's really nothing left. So the idiom is a physical thing, but working yourself to the bone does not necessarily connotate only physicality. It could be emotional, spiritual, right? How's it spiritual? Right? How's it spiritual? When you're in a very bad work environment, right? Like I am. I'm in a bad work environment. I'll probably get to that as we go along. It impacts your spirituality potentially. Let's say, for example, you get called in. Like you're a Christian person and you go in to church on Sunday mornings and you got a job that starts demanding you to come into work on Sunday mornings, right? Your spirituality may be contingent upon your presence in your church amongst your people, the hearing your pastor speak on things, everything about going to church, right? For a lot of people, you know, showing up on Sunday is like the weekly reset to give you like a spiritual connection for the week ahead to help you get through it, right? And of course, with the Protestants, maybe the Romans too, you tend to have like a Bible study on Wednesday in the middle of the week. So if you can't really make it through the week on the fuel of your Sunday sermon, you could go in for kind of a refresher on Wednesday night, break the week in half. Of course, Orthodox Church, we have all kinds of things going on during the week. It's not really like that. It's an ongoing thing. It's a very alive church. Regrettably, okay, now here's an example. My job has me pushed to late hours every weekday to the point where I cannot get up to the church in time. I miss like half of everything that they do on weeknights up there. So I don't go, and I've become a weekend warrior, which is not my case. So does that impact my spirituality? In my case, I have a very present and full life with direct contact with the Lord, right? In prayer, and I entered into Orthodoxy like this. I don't really depend on Sundays, Wednesdays, any days at all. I could go long stretches and still be a very spiritual person, but I do understand how other people can be affected by it, right? And this is just an example I'm given, right? Your spirituality, you'd be affected. And with that, your emotions can be brought down, right? You know, in relation to it, in direct correlation to your spirituality taking a dive, your emotions can go with that. But even without the spiritual concern of it all, just the work will get on your emotions, right? We have a very negative environment in here. And again, like I said, I kind of get into that. I expect I'll get into that before we're done. It's like you're walking into a fog, a dark fog, a cold fog, a wet fog. You feel like crap all the time. You don't really know what's going on. And everybody's sharing in this same misery, right? It's a cultural phenomenon that is actually the sinister resonance of the management regime, right? It sucks. It's a very unhappy place. And it's hard, you know, it's hard to be happy. In fact, when you try to happy, you could joke around, you bust balls like people do when they're on the job. You know, you whistle, you sing, you listen to music, you do anything to get through the toil of your labor in the course of a day. And everybody understands that. But sometimes you get management that wants to shit on all that, right? There's no happiness. You're not allowed to be happy. You're not allowed to be happy. It's a horrible, horrible, horrible thing. But see, you got like an emotional bone, a spiritual bone, physical bone, all these like parts of what makes us up as human beings, right? Get exhausted, get worn out, ground down, even harmed by long-term intense labor, right? We do need rest from it. We do need a break from it, right? But that's the idiom, working your fingers to the bone. It's, you know, working to the point of harming yourself. And, you know, I get into this, like, situation at work, this dismal situation that we're under, and, you know, the unhappiness of it all. There's a tyranny involved with it, right? Like I said, it's a bad management situation. It's a bad management situation. There's really bad blood between management and labor in this place. It's been going on for a year and a half. It's tough to pick your head up every day, go into work. It's tough to drag your ass begrudgingly. You don't want to work for somebody who is so cruel to not only you, but the people around you, you know? You get to resenting your work rather than being gratified by it. Even my shitty job, I can be gratified. I could come in here, work hard in the day, get things done, make a difference, right? And go home feeling good about it. Knowing that the wind is going to blow, trash is going to come up, the dandelions are going to grow, people are going to piss on the floor, people are going to throw garbage at the floor when they miss their trash can, and tomorrow it's just all over again, right? But each night I could basically pat myself on the back knowing I put in a day's work. But now it's like I can't even get a good feeling about that because I resent doing it for somebody who is tyrannical, right? Tyrannical. And that's American. That's a very American way to be. We do not like tyranny. And I don't understand how anybody in any company who takes the management role thinks it's somehow okay in this country with this general culture to be tyrannical. But it happens. It happens. I'm not going to say it happens every time, but I've seen it in my life, you know. For every 5 jobs I got, there's always that one tyrant type of person. And, man, it sucks. And then, you know, think about, like, just the history of everything, right? When you have a tyrant in charge, hey, look at slavery, right? Just general chattel slavery. You can look at this in a couple of different ways, right? The basic way we look at it is like you got slaves on a plantation. You got a tyrannical slave master that works everybody, not only fingers to the bone, but literally works them to death, right? Splits families up, rapes teenage girls, you know, that whole kind of thing. A very bad connotation. But which is equated with a tyrannical rule, right? Tyrannical. I hate to use the word master. Master really means a teacher, but that's how you refer to the slave lord. It'd really be a lord of a plantation, but we call them slave masters. On the other hand, slavery could potentially just be an economical institution. You know, you take people and you could put them out in a country setting. A plantation is a gorgeous place. Think of the southern plantation. Massive acreage, lush, growing, you know, big shade trees, rivers or creeks running through. You know, you get to the end of your work day and you get your little cabin to go in, your shade tree over it, you build a little fire. And it's a very pleasant life, and you don't have the headache of all the overhead of the business and everything like that, which is what management people tend to, right? You just do your labor, and it actually makes you strong, healthy, as long as you're not working yourself to the bone over it, right? As long as you're not being beaten into it, like was known to happen here in this country, in the South in the old days, and as long as you hold your family together and things like that, it can actually just be
one way of attaining the very simple life that so many of us crave. And by us, I mean me, right? I just want a simple life. When it comes to my labor, right? I don't want all the complications of everything. I want the freedom to explore hobbies, interests, you know, further learning. I'm always reading something, always learning something. And that's me. But then enjoying the company of the people who I love and respect around me, who encourage me, who pray for me, you know, all that kind of stuff. There's good to be had. And the only difference really between the two. Now, talking about chattel slavery, right, as an economic institution, is that person which lords over you, which lords over your situation. You got a douchebag or you got somebody who's good. That's the difference between a good life and a bad life, right? Even in slavery. And of course, that slave master would always have the option of setting people free periodically, to giving them an education and letting them be free. I can't imagine being in that situation, right, where I have people like actually slaves working for me for years without cutting them loose at some point in their life. Why they still have life to live, why they're still young enough to appreciate their freedom, and getting them an education so they don't go out blind into this rotten world, right? You know, of course, I can't even imagine being in that situation at all. But if I was, it would just seem natural to me to retire people early, use them for labor, be kind to them, let them establish their families and everything, and let them have an option to go at some point. See if they want to go and tell them that they can come back if they don't like what they see out there. Right. Much like the Amish people do with their teenage kids. They send them off for a year. Let them go figure out if the world's worth their bother, and then they come back, right? But anyway, you know, another form of slavery is the forced labor, like concentration camps. I'll bring that up periodically because my family went through that shit, right? My grandparents, my uncles, aunts were literally slaves also in a different form, right? First, they had to survive Stalin, the Soviets, the communists, like I was railing about prior episode, right? The real cancer of the world, the real scumbags. And Joseph Stalin was like, his rule, his reign was the epitome of tyranny and the murder that happened under him at the behest of his handlers, who I will not name right now. My parents managed to survive that and managed to get politically dispossessed from that, run off to a concentration camp in Germany, and was worked to the bone, you know, in forced labor. There was a situation where you were literally getting worked to death, and my family survived it. Every single person involved. My father was literally born there, a baby there. My grandmother had a pregnancy. She was pregnant there under forced labor, had a baby, and managed to keep that baby alive until, as the story goes, if you haven't heard it before, the first black person that these Ukrainian peasants ever laid eyes on was an American GI that kicked the door open on their bunker and released them, right? Really a good story. But you got that forced labor, and there's a tyranny involved with that too, right? When all you're good for is a short period of time working, you're round the clock. What my grandfather was doing, as far as I understand, was building concrete bunkers around the camp, around the city, right? So he was doing concrete work, what, 12, 15 hours a day or more? It was something ridiculous, and I think my grandmother was off in some ammunition factory, right? Something like that. But they survived. They survived both the Stalin and Hitler, and, you know, working to the bone, they still managed to hang in there. Yeah, really incredible stuff. And then there's these, you know, workaholics, right? You got these workaholic people. you think of working yourself to the bone, then you look at, you know, I described that as working hard over a long period of time, and you look around and you get a lot of like management people who work 11, 12 hours every day, and then they'll come in on their off days, right? On the one hand, you think, wow, they are really dedicated, and they really put in a lot of time to make this shit happen. And then on the other hand, you think, hey, anybody who has put this organization together has looked at their roles and expected for them to work 8-hour days, maybe 5 days a week, and get the job done. So why aren't they getting the job done? Why are they working 60 hours when 40 should do it? Are they really bad at what they're doing? Or are they working 40 hours and then hanging around for another 20, right? You see what I'm saying? You see what I'm getting to? The hanging around for another 20 part, that ain't working your fingers to the bone. It creates the impression, but it ain't the truth. What's the rest of the truth? Well, it's a mystery. It's a secret, right? I got a story, a little story. I may have told it here before, too. I used to work for a guy, an Orthodox Jew. I worked for him. Our office was up in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, which is at the George Washington Bridge, right across from Harlem, South Bronx, right over the river, the Hudson River, that far north in Manhattan, right at the very tippy-tip top of Manhattan. And he worked there. He had his office there. I had a couple offices around. I had one up there. And he lived down the shore in Jersey. He had a good, hour and a half, 2-hour ride home. He was in Monmouth County. It ain't the furthest extent of the shore, but it's a pretty good ride, right? Either way, it was certainly over an hour. It might have been close to two. But he had that long of a commute. That's coming and going, right? So he's spending anywhere from 2 to 4 hours a day driving. He stayed in the office from like 6 a.m. to like 11 p.m. Seriously, right? He worked a day like that. And I can't imagine. I worked for him. It was an IT thing, right? I was a database programmer. I did graphic user interfaces for an inventory system, you know. And I don't know everything that guy was involved with. I can't speak to the details of his job. He was my manager. There's more to the picture than would ever meet my eye. But I can't imagine how he would work that. And he would work over the weekends, too. Both days. It's just incredible. But as I was there a while, I started to hear about like him and his personal life. He would say so himself. He had like 8 kids, right? He had some real bitch of a wife at home, and he ate 8 kids, and the place was bedlam, and he couldn't stand being home. You see what I'm saying? You understand the angle I'm taking here, right? The tangent I'm on? You'll get people that hang around a workplace with the appearance that they are working their fingers to the bone, when in actuality, they are just trying to avoid going home, right? It's the same gripe I have when I'm commuting. I'm in traffic. The place I always want to be is the sanctuary of my house beside my wife. That is my favorite place on earth, right? I always want to be there, and I want to be there just as quick as I can get there. And I have this foolish assumption that most everybody else is the same way. You get out of work and you want to get home. But why am I driving in traffic when it's not a volume issue? There's space on the road. People are going 10 miles an hour under the speed limit. Right down the middle of the road, right down the middle of the highway. They are in no hurry, all right? And you don't need to be in a hurry just to do the speed limit, you know? You don't need to be in a hurry to be like, just stay right and get the hell out of people's way. Be conscientious. You don't need to be driving aggressively to get somewhere expeditiously. But here we go. We got a whole world of people that don't want to go home. And like, I recall this story with the Orthodox Jew IT director I used to work for. That's a man that didn't want to be home. And I'm driving in amongst people that don't really want to get where they're going to. That's a sad state of affairs. You've got the world backwards if you prefer to be at work rather than at home. Everything is twisted up and you need Jesus. I'm just telling you right now, all right? I'll just tell you that right now. I'm all about a simple life, right? Then, like I mentioned before, I don't want to get into like a secondary rant about slavery and forms of slavery, but I think it is Nine Inch Nails song from their Broken EP, right? It's called Happiness and Slavery, right? Now, I'm sure it's not talking about pulling cotton in the field type of slavery. It's just like where Trent Reznor was concerned. It was always him being tangled up with some twisted woman, right? Probably treated him like a slave, and he would learn to be happy within that treatment, long as he got what he wanted out of the deal. This song is more on that line, right? It's on that line. But the title, the chorus, the basic gist of it. You know, when I think about being a slave on a plantation in the South under a good lord of the land, right? Life could be pleasant, it could be easy, it could be simple, and you could be happy in it. It doesn't have to be a misery, right? And I'm not saying that was the case for people. I'm saying the potential is there for that. And you can accept those terms. You can accept those conditions. You could actually prefer that than to going out into the world with your quote-unquote freedom, right? Because everything is set for you. I think a good, quote-unquote, master would set it up that way. I would like a simple life. If somebody put an offer to me, like, all right, you could spend like 10 years working for me in this environment, this situation, your family's welcome, we'll give you housing, and you know, we'll take care of your health and everything, and we'll actually put away a little money for you, and in 10 years you could be free and we'll set you off into the world. In the meantime, we'll give you a little education, all that. It's like, I would think about that, you know? I would think about that. I'm a guy who likes to roam. I'm a guy who likes to ramble. But I would think about something like that. There's a security to that, right? And there's a potential pleasantness to it, as long as I'm not being worked to death, right? A simple life. So I try to carve out a simple life without the plantation, right? Just do what I can in the world to make things simple. I get a simple job. I make just barely adequate enough money to live on. Maybe get a small retirement, a little pension, when I'm too old to do it anymore. And on the way, enjoy the simple things, right? Enjoy the simple things. Have hobbies. Have time with my wife and, you know, the spiritual pursuits, a church, the friends that I have, all that stuff. That's really what life is about, moment to moment. And I basically have that. I basically have the simplicity of it all. The one thorn in my side is this management situation on the job. I've got a simple job. I've got all the liberty. I just go get it done. No. It has to be tangled up. It has to be twisted up. It has to be confused. You know, my goals here are constantly a moving target. I have no idea what actual expectations are. I don't. My job used to be I knew what the manager wanted. My expectations was to try to measure up to what the management wanted me to do. Now I don't even know what the management wants me to do day to day. Because when I do it and there's success and things look great and everything works right, I'm still getting attacked. It's almost like on a monthly basis. There's always something, some kind of nitpicking, some kind of pettiness, some kind of vindictiveness, some kind of tyranny. And I may get into something like that too. But I just want a simple life. I crafted a simple life for myself. You know, I put in my time here. I made my bones, right? There's another idiom with bones. I made my bones. I did the hard stuff up front to justify a level existence the rest of the way, right? I earned my weekends off. I earned vacation time. I earned vacation time when I wanted to take it. I even earned a better daytime schedule, which I have not been granted. You know, I've earned all this stuff by making my bones, by putting in my time and my effort, right? And this person just can't accept anybody being content with their life. So they will mess with the life, right? They'll mess with their life. And I think this simple life that I've crafted for myself, and I was living it there for a minute, you know, before this came along. Leonard Skinner, Simple Man, right? 1973, Leonard Skinner's first album, Pronounced Leonard Skinner, my favorite, always been my favorite. It was one of the first albums I ever owned, right? Love that album. And yeah, Simple Man is on that album. Be a simple kind of man. Be something you love and understand. Yeah. A mother teaching the son about pursuing life for the simplicity and meaning in things in it, and don't be caught up in your pursuit of what the rich man's gold, right? Don't get tangled up with the pursuit of money, because you have a way of selling your soul out in that process, right? Leonard Skinner, great old band from the 70s, you know. There is much life outside of labor, right? You got hobbies, church, civic clubs, volunteer for things, you know, give back to society. Your family, of course, your friends, of course. Just resting from the toil of your labor is a pleasure, right? And then the pursuit of your dreams. You may be an actor. You may be an actress, an artist. You may be a writer. Like, I have a dream. I'm writing a book, right? You have a pursuit of these things, and you supplement that pursuit by working these work-a-day Joe jobs. So for most of us, a job is just a job. This is what we're doing. This is the point of it all. And then you end up like the Lover Boy song. What was it, 1980, 1979, 1981, somewhere around that? Lover Boy, some band from Canada. And I don't know jack shit about them, right? They were on MTV. They had their one song. Well, they might have had another song or two. I'm not familiar. Everybody's Working for the Weekend, right? Everybody's Working for the Weekend. That rang true, right? It was just such a common sentiment. Monday starts and somebody asks you, hey, how you doing? It's like, already, I'm already focused on Saturday, Friday night, Saturday. Monday through Friday afternoon is just this drudgery of time that I've got to put in to have the liberty that I have on freedom, liberty I have on weekends to pursue interests unabated, you know, to let go of all my responsibility and get on with other things, right? The sentiment of that song, everybody's working for the weekend, it was a very common thing, and it wasn't that great of a song, but it was very popular, and you know, with a couple of beers, it probably sounded better, just like, you know, Ugly Woman looks better, right, in a bar. But you could play that on a Thursday night on payday, you know, people are having their happy hour, and it'll just ring true with them. They're a day away, they're already buzzed, and tomorrow's Friday night, and then the weekend after that, you know, it's like, yeah, everybody's working for the weekend, right? Yep. But what I'm saying is, for most of us, a job is just a job, you know? And then you got other people that they've made a career out of what they're doing, and for some obviously psychological / psychiatric reason, they just need to mess with people. And this is kind of where I'm at.
This monologue is continued in the next episode, Chapter 00075. Bones of Contention, Part 3.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Arlen Monologics. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.